From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Sylvie Drake is my guest. She is a translator, a writer, a poet, and for many, many years she was the theater critic and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Most recently, she served as director of publications for the Denver Center of the Performing Arts, and she can also be seen hilariously on the website Old Jews Telling Jokes. Sylvie Drake, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
Have you heard any good jokes lately?
Well, actually, I get a few on the internet, but I can't always remember them to be able to relate one quickly.
That's okay.
They're usually a little longer, but very funny, some of them.
Yeah, well, yours is the one that I saw you tell on the internet a while back is hysterical.
They were pretty funny.
But you're not old.
No, of course not. I'm always young at heart, you know that. That's the important part.
Yeah. So, you, when I was living in Los Angeles when I was younger, I used to read your column often. And how did you get started with the LA Times?
Oh, it's a wonderful and kind of a long story. I don't have time, I don't think, to tell you the whole thing in detail on your show. But I got started because I was working on my master's. And I interviewed Dan Sullivan for my master's, and I was doing a the whole focus of the master's was on the Inner City Cultural Center at the time. And Dan was new in town, and he said he wanted to read it because he thought he might learn something from reading it. And so when I was done, I gave it to him to read, and I asked him if he had a job for me. And he said, I don't have a job, but I can use a stringer. And so I started that way, and then later it turned into a job. I'm simplifying it a lot, but basically how it happened.
Yeah.
And we really got along beautifully. I mean, we were well matched, so we really had 18 wonderful years together. Yeah. I always felt that he was the brother I'd never had.
And when you were at the paper, you were actually at the paper. I mean, it wasn't like you could...
Yes.
You didn't,
yes.
Couldn't email it in. There was no such thing there.
No, you had to actually walk it in.
And you sat with a typewriter.
Yes, and 6 carbon copies.
And did you have to go to a show and then rush in there at night so that they could get the review in the paper?
No, I didn't do it that, Gary, and you are a contemporary of my daughter, Jessica. I would come home. I've never been able to write a review late at night or at night when, you know, just immediately after seeing a show. I need to digest what I've seen. And I would get up very, very early in the morning and do a draft. Then I'd wake up my children, get them ready to go to school. Then I'd do a second draft. And then I'd drive it down to the paper at that point.
Hmm.
And they needed it by 10, 11 o'clock. That was the deadline.
Wow. So that was you wrote the thing 3 or 4 times. That's writing was so good.
You know, writing is always rewriting. You know that.
Yes. People don't do that so much anymore, maybe.
You know, there was only one person at the paper who actually could sit down and write a review and never change a word, and that was Chuck Champlin.
Mm. Yeah.
Amazing. I've never known anyone to be able to do it that way, but he did.
And quite a good writer, he was.
And a very good writer.
Yeah.
Very good writer. But I always have been a rewriter.
Yeah. And what made you become a writer when you were working on your thesis? You were already a writer.
Well, I think I was a writer from the day I was born. It's one of those things that you sort of discover about yourself. As you get older, you discover it even more. I did want to start... When I started out, I wanted to be an actor, and after I went to the Pasadena Playhouse, I really decided 2 things. I decided I really didn't enjoy rehearsals. I thought they were boring because they were so repetitious. That's not a good thing for an actor.
No.
And secondly, I decided I was very interested in directing because I had full control over the whole production. And I liked that. And of course, once I went back to school and was looking for something to do that would actually help me make a living, I discovered that I really liked criticism, because criticism was directing backwards.
Hmm.
And I tested myself by writing for a paper that was distributed in the Hills for free, and they didn't have a theater critic, so I called and asked if they wanted one, and we got together and they took me on, just primarily to see if I really had an aptitude for it. I had no idea at the time how difficult it is to even find a job as a critic that would pay you any money. And it was a combination of all the factors that I've mentioned, you know, meeting Dan, being able to talk to him and ask him about writing for him and so on. So I ended up where I ended up almost by chance. But that's what life is, you know, a lot of the time.
Right, being in the right place at the right time.
Yes,
and having a background then in acting and in directing in some way qualified you to critique theater. I mean, we live now in this era that's like beyond criticism, where everybody is a critic and, you know, everybody puts in their 2 cents on Amazon or whatever. Maybe the era of the theater critic is over, but in your case, you were a very insightful and great one.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting question, if I may answer it quite fully, because I knew a couple of other critics who shall remain nameless because it's not important, but they also had a background in theater. One of them was not a good critic. I had a background in theater, and I always thought that helped me. But then I also knew Dan, for example, who had no background in theater. I mean, he knew it by studying it, but he had no background. He was a very good critic. So it doesn't seem to hold together, that theory. I think the most important requisites for a good critic is to understand deadlines, certainly to understand the discipline that you're critiquing, and to know how to write. I mean, it's those three things. But in my case, it just all came together. It was like the little light bulb, you know, that lights up. And I thought, yeah, I love the theater. I love writing. I love to write about the theater. And it just worked out for me.
It was an exciting time in Los Angeles theater. You know, I'm sort of a theater snob, and I think, you know, Broadway, I like to see a show on Broadway. I saw a show on Broadway a couple of years ago, saw the exact same show in San Francisco. I didn't think it was very good in San Francisco. I thought it was great in New York. I don't know what it is about that, but
I've had the reverse experience sometimes, Gary.
Yeah.
I've seen shows on the road, particularly when I was in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
I'd see the shows in New York and liked them, and then the touring company would come through, and I'd see it again, and it was better sometimes, a lot better.
Well,
I don't know that that necessarily holds up, but it's amazing how many times. The other thing that I find is that quite often when a play is really good, really well written, and you have a New York production that's a big success, and then other theaters around the country pick up the play, not the production, just the play, and do their own production. I have seen those sometimes be absolutely stunning in other places, not just New York.
Hmm.
I think the whole New York mystique is really a bit of a joke, but and especially now when so much money is really all about greed, all about, you know, how expensive can we make the ticket?
Yes.
I resent that. I really resent that in New York. And I don't think it's the spirit of theater at all, but I realize also there are realities about theater, and it is an expensive, very labor-intensive art form.
You've got so many people involved in putting on the production every night.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things I want to say about, you mentioned the fact that now everybody's a critic, and that's true.
Yeah.
And I do think that the era of the theater critic is kind of gone. Also, there are so many fewer newspapers,
right.
fewer outlets, except for social media.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine as far as it goes, but I really think that, in fact, I wrote an article about that, which appeared in LA Stage, you know, the publication of the Stage Alliance when they had one.
Yeah.
I had written it at Lee Melville's request in response to a comment by Les Spindle, you know, about what is going on with criticism and is there a need for critics anymore. And I said the problem with everyone being a critic is that instead of leveling the playing field, it has flattened it. You don't get good writing. You just get people who say, I like this or I don't like this,
mm-hmm.
for this reason or that reason. It's not exciting. When you had really good critics, they knew how to articulate not only their reasons for liking or disliking a play, but doing it with a certain level of grace and a certain level of verve. And that's what you need, and that's what really is kind of gone.
The literary form of criticism, that is,
yes.
criticism as literature, as opposed to,
yes.
it, I give it an A, or I give it 4 stars, or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the up and down. It's really what I call the mercantile review, you know, not the art.
Should you spend your money rather than...
Exactly.
Let's ruminate on this piece of theater.
Exactly.
We're talking with Sylvie Drake. She was the longtime theater critic for the Los Angeles Times. And I think, you know, nowadays shows can be terrible and run forever and be great and close. Whereas in the day when the theater critic ruled, that was less likely to happen.
Probably so. And I think that the smaller theaters particularly benefited a lot from a good review. And, of course, they did not do well with bad ones. But they needed those reviews more than anyone. And I don't know what they're getting today or what they're not getting today. But, you know, I'm still doing a little reviewing for culturalweekly.com, but I do it from time to time, and to be honest with you, I pick and choose what I'm going to see because I've seen enough bad plays to last me 10 lifetimes.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that, because I did speak with Robert Hilburn, who was also a critic at the LA Times,
yeah.
and he wrote
good one.
Yeah, and he told me that since he stopped writing rock and roll, he wrote rock and roll criticism, that he doesn't go to rock and roll shows and he doesn't listen to rock and roll records, and he listens to the stuff he always listened to, but he has sort of stopped going. Well, but you haven't. You still like to go to theater and write about theater.
I like to go to theater, and I like especially to, you know, I like to pick and choose. You get to the point where you can more or less determine if it's going to be something that will be interesting. I'm not asking for the moon. I just want to be interested. I want to be engaged by what I see. I don't want to go just for the entertainment value. I want more than that out of a play.
Well, I remember in Los Angeles when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of marvelous productions and a lot of people who, you know, you thought of as movie stars. I remember seeing Henry Fonda quite a few times at one of those little theaters, Huntington Hartford, I think it was.
Yes.
And
not so little. But
well, maybe that's not the one. What was the one that was a little smaller?
There was also a smaller theater on Hollywood Boulevard that they actually named the Fonda after.
Oh, yeah, that was probably the one. It was called something else then, though.
It was, yes, it was, and I don't remember what.
Avon or something. But what did you see, you know, that's in your career that you'll never forget? I mean, you've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of plays.
You know, you say you're still that I'm still going to the theater. Yes, because my introduction to the theater was probably one of the most unforgettable ones. And I'll tell you what it was. I grew up, as you may or may not know, in Egypt. And I was in my teens during the... now I'm really dating myself. But I was in my teens during the Second World War, when we were not getting the touring companies anymore. There was no theater in Egypt, but there were touring companies that used to come. And, of course, it all stopped with the Second World War. After, or shortly toward the end of the war, when the war was waning and we knew that, you know, we were going to win it, I had an English teacher who loved the theater. And she found out that John Gielgud was going to do Hamlet at the Cairo Opera House. Now, we were in Alexandria, which is 2 or 3 hours away, and she wanted very much to see him, so she organized a class trip. Well, I didn't know from Shakespeare, I didn't know from Hamlet, I didn't know, but I thought, oh, class trip, what fun, we'll get on the train, we'll go over there, we'll have fun. That was all as far as I could see. Well, then, seeing that performance changed my life. And I'm not joking. I was completely, completely bowled over by him. And to finish the story, because it really, you know, talk about good luck. When I went to work for the LA Times as a stringer, before I was on staff, Gielgud was in town, and Dan asked me to interview him. And I did. And the first thing I did when I went to the interview, I took a couple of books I had of his that I had bought, one of which had actually gone through a flood in my basement, but I still had it. And I said to him, before we started the interview, I said, I'm going to tell you something that won't mean a thing to you. I said, but you changed my life. Because from the moment I saw him in that performance, I knew that all I wanted to do with my life is be in the theater, connected to the theater, somehow be part of it. And I said to him, I saw you at the Cairo Opera House in 1945, do Hamlet. And he looked at me and he said, you know, those were the last performances I ever gave because I felt I was getting too old for the part. So I snuck under that line. And we had a wonderful interview. It was printed in the paper, and then he wrote me the sweetest note, which I still have.
Wow. And his performance of Hamlet was really a revolution in theater. He was the kind of the first person to do Shakespeare in a kind of a conversational way, not a sing-song kind of way.
It was not a sing-song way at all, but what it was that was so revolutionary, it was really that he was so right for the part.
Mm.
His own temperament and his emotional ability, his ability to project emotion, is what I should call it, was so acute and so right for Hamlet. And then he had something which, of course, at the time that I saw it, I didn't realize that it was something he was just good at. But he, you know, after the scene in which the king runs out of the room because he can't stand to watch the murder recreated, and Hamlet has all those lines to Guildenstern and Rosencrantz, and then he runs to kill the king and can't do it because he says if I do, he's praying and his soul will go to heaven. All those scenes he played with tears rolling down his cheeks.
Wow.
And he has said since then, but not at the time that I saw it, I didn't know. He has said since then that he could cry on command. But the effect was unbelievable. He was, you know, the voice was high-pitched at that point. You could tell he was hysterical. You could tell he was just very, very intense, and then these tears just rolling down his cheeks.
It was
unforgettable.
It's very rare to see Shakespeare and really feel... because Shakespeare is so stylized that the actors are just speaking their words the way when you see, you know, I don't know, Our Town, it feels much more like they're actually talking. I mean, but so he was able to do that by...
Well, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
He subsequently directed, right? He directed Richard Burton in Hamlet.
I don't remember that. Did he?
Yeah, I believe so.
He may have. He did a lot of directing.
Yeah.
I know that. And he may have directed that one production that I saw. It was an ENSAP production, which is like the English USO.
Uh-huh.
So he was touring, you know, some of the bases, some of the army outposts, etc. But anyway, and then my whole life after that, being at the LA Times, was so rich because I interviewed people like Harold Pinter. I became a close friend, actually, of Eugene Ionesco's because I spoke French.
Mm.
And then he wanted me to be his interpreter whenever he had to speak. He didn't know a word of English, you know. He
really?
Called it that damned language. That's what he called it. He hated English. But he, you know, the first time I met him, I had been sent to interview him, and I could do it in French, and then I wrote it in English. And I saw him the following day. I forget why we were meeting, but we were meeting for some reason. And he said to me, "I read your article. Somebody read it to me." And I thought, uh-oh, now I'm going to get it. He said, "You quoted me correctly." From that moment on, you know, he really trusted that I would interpret him correctly. And when he appeared at the New York New Play Festival in the 80s, he requested that they fly me out there. And they did.
Oh, how great.
Yeah, he was quite a guy, manic depressive, very complicated person. But I did get to know him and his wife, and I even visited them in their apartment in Paris. I was there. Very interesting man, very interesting.
And you've worked as a translator also.
Yes, in fact, I did a translation. I was commissioned by the Denver Center to do a translation of The Servant of Two Masters. And I did it from the Venetian dialect of the period, which is not easy. But I had some help from Italian translations that I also came across. I speak three languages, English, French, and Italian. Those are the three. And then I know smatterings of other things. And it's not a great credit to me. It's just that I grew up in a country where everybody spoke three or four languages. It was not unusual.
I speak a little English.
Well, you do it very well.
Oh, thanks.
Anyway, the upshot of what I was about to tell you is that 2 days ago I got a call from someone at USC, and they want to do my translation of Serpent of Two Masters in a college production in February or March of next year. So I feel very flattered.
Congratulations.
It was kind of fun. Came right out of the blue. I had no idea.
We're chatting with Sylvie Drake, who was for many years the theater critic for the Los Angeles Times.
You know, I met a lot of fascinating people. I did a very long interview with Harold Pinter, and I was so intimidated at the idea that I was going to actually be interviewing Harold Pinter that I read everything I could before I walked into that interview. And he was in St. Louis. He was touring with, I think it was Betrayal, and with Liv Ullmann. He was in it. And I flew to St. Louis because they were playing there before coming to L.A. And because I was so well prepared, we ended up having a wonderful interview and spending 2 hours together just talking. It was just fascinating. So I've had very good luck in terms of the people I got to meet, the people I got to know. I even made some wonderful friends, such as Patricia Morrison, who is a friend to this day. So, it enriches your life tremendously, just tremendously.
Yeah, and how do you have a different feeling about film than theater?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I actually reviewed a couple of films. Usually they were films that had some connection to the theater. But I found that to be such a deadly, boring thing to do because you sit in a small screening room, at least in those days, and with a bunch of other critics, you know, you get very tired of seeing the same critics everywhere you go. but you know, you do. You sit in this little screening room, you watch a movie, you have no influence over the movie, whereas you can influence a theatrical performance, but you have no influence. The movie's in the can.
So you're saying if somebody reads your criticism of their play, they might change?
Well, it's happened.
Sylvie Drake says we should do it.
It's happened, but it's not the goal. Uh-huh. The goal is not to tell the director what to do.
Yeah.
The goal is to really try to evaluate whether it was a worthwhile experience. But it has happened. I mean, I remember a Neil Simon play. They're playing our song.
Mm-hmm.
He opened it at the Amundsen, you know, before it went anywhere else. And in that initial version, there was a boyfriend involved whom we never see. He's not a character in the play. She just always talks about this boyfriend. And you know she would like to get rid of him, but she hasn't figured out how to do it. Well, in the second act, Neil Simon simply had the guy die of cancer. which is completely non-dramatic.
And not conducive to comedy at all.
No, and it's not a solution. It's not a theatrical solution. It's a cop-out is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it, and so did Ron Pennington from The Hollywood Reporter. We both picked up on that, and he changed it.
Hmm.
He changed it.
He had him die of a coronary instead.
Well, you know, I don't even remember what he did. The guy, they just broke up. They somehow broke up. There was no illness. There was no garbage like that. It's funny. And then later on, I reviewed Jake's Women at the Old Globe, which was a play that he had already booked a Broadway house for. And it was not a good play, at least at that point it was not. And it was a tricky review to do because I knew he was ready to go to Broadway with it. It was his own money that he'd spent on booking that house. And it was not good. And I gave it the review that it deserved. And he canceled the booking.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years later or a year later, sometime, it was some substantial time later, he did open it in New York. He'd done some work on it. It was much better. It still is not one of his great plays, but it was much better. And I reviewed it there and said that. And he wrote me a letter, and we had a correspondence for about, I would say, maybe 3 or 4 letters. But what he wrote to me about was to say, you did me a favor, because I did do the work I needed to do on it, and that's why it became better. You know, and it was a very nice exchange. I mean, it ended up being a very nice... I still have all these letters. One of these days I should do something with them.
Well, how about today? Today be...
Yes,
when we get off the phone, I want you to compile these letters.
Anyway, so when you say is there an influence, yes, sometimes there is. But that's not the point. You know, you can't do the work for the playwright. You can't do the work for the actor. They have to do it. But you can say... this works or this doesn't work, at least for me. Whereas in film, that's it. It's in the can.
Yeah. Well, you've had a fascinating career, Sylvie Drake, and I want to thank you so much for spending some time talking to me here on From the Book Show.
It's wonderful to talk to you, and I appreciate the time spent together. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did and that you'll come back and hear us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, the lovely Sylvie Drake, for joining us. And I want to tell you that From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas, and that I'm Gary Shapiro saying good night, everybody.